First of all, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Perfect. Yesterday, I had just a little glitch. My computer, I was at a meeting and, you know, they were asking for volunteers to read this, that, the other thing. And I kept volunteering and they weren't picking on me. And I'm like, oh, okay. Somebody else's turn. Turned out my audio was broken. So they couldn't hear me. So I didn't realize that until after the meeting was over. So I just wanted to double check and make sure. Is it 15 minutes, Blair, for my share? Oh, you're muted now.
20 minutes, Sandy.
Oh, 20 minutes. Oh, my God.
Up to 20 minutes.
20, like, you got 20 in you, Sandy.
Yeah. Yeah, we could be here till noon. We could be here till noon. Okay. Well, that's, hang on a second, because I do set a little timer for myself just in case I get either off on a tangent or whatever. Okay. My name is Sandy. I am a grateful, recovering, compulsive overeater and food addict of many, many, many years. I know quite a few of you have heard me speak and share my story. Too bad. Sorry. I always start with the third step prayer. So forgive me for one second. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Amen. Okay. I always say that because I can get in my own way, and my ego and my just self-centeredness can kind of shift me off of God's path sometimes. Who knew, you know? And you'll have to forgive me. I have to leave the meeting a few minutes early today. I have to go have blood work. And because of that, it means I've had no coffee this morning, okay, at 5 a.m. in the morning. I know, eeks. So you're going to get what you get. And yeah. And the funny part is I only drink decaf because I can't have caffeine. So, but I have that cup of decaf first thing in the morning when I wake up, and it just does something for me. Okay. Well, you know what? That probably starts it off right there. I'm an addict. Doesn't matter what substance it is. I am addicted to feeling better. I am addicted to stuffing down the feelings of anxiety, fear, anything. And that's the disease of compulsive eating and food addiction for me. That's how it started. And it started at the age of 3 years old. I have a very distinct memory of being in the kitchen, my mom giving me a banana. I ate the banana and I liked it and I wanted more. And she said, no, I was 3 years old. And she put the bunch on the counter and I, at my tiny little self, pushed the chair over, climbed up, grabbed the bunch and ate the entire bunch of bananas. Okay. Now I was 3 years old and I think about that today because I can remember the feeling of relief, the sensation in my body of stuffing down those bananas, like just like a pig. I can feel it. Now, a rational, sane person does not do that. Yeah, you know, you have a cookie, you want another cookie. Yeah, you may have a few cookies, but a box of cookies is a serving size for me. It always has been, you know, a bunch of bananas is a serving size. So the ism, the disease of compulsive eating, which is for me a fatal disease, it came close to killing me many times over the years. So I don't take this disease lightly. It is, you know, no coincidence that, you know, my recovery is in the big book, which is where the promises come from. And it comes from the big book because the big book was written, you know, for alcoholics. My eating is alcoholic eating. There's no difference, absolutely no difference than me shooting a needle in my arm with heroin or downing a case of vodka than it is to go into the store and get a bag full of junk food and hide in my car and eat it. There's no difference. And it's just as fatal, except it may not be quite as quick. You know, I think for me, that's the difference between alcohol, drugs, other things is, you know, what do they say? I forget that there's a saying, something like drugs or whatever, but liquor is quicker, you know, I don't know. But anyway, like I said, it's 5 o'clock in the morning with no coffee. So let me just get back to it. All right. So I grew up a compulsive eater. My mom was always heavy. She was older when she had me. She was 40 years old, you know, which I considered, oh my goodness, you know, she was an old woman when she had me by today's standards. Not so much. But growing up, it felt that way to me because all of my friends' mothers were in their, you know, 30s. And, you know, my mother was overweight. She was older. She was sick. And they had young, thin, active mothers. And my life was one of self-pity, you know, because I did not have the same kind of mom that they did. You know, she couldn't go do things with me. But the things that we did do together was we would walk hand in hand 2 miles to the ice cream store and go grab, you know, a half gallon of ice cream to come back and eat that night. So we did do things together, but it was always food related. Anyway, I grew up feeling different from everybody else, you know, and in many ways I was different physically and financially. I lived in an extremely wealthy community on the wrong side of the tracks, wearing hand-me-down clothes. And, you know, my friends, when they weren't friends, I didn't really have a lot of friends because I didn't reach out. I was very, very isolated because I felt so different. You know, but they had governesses and maids and, you know, all sorts of stuff, you know, and I'm wearing hand-me-down clothes and I had freckles and curly hair, which was not in back then, you know, and buck teeth. And I was laughed at and I was teased. And, you know, I look back on it today. I just recently did another fourth step, a very, very, very in-depth fourth step. And I looked at a lot of those things and, you know, those perceptions that I had about how people were looking at me may very well have been just my perceptions and not the way it was at all. You know, I was so sensitive. I took everything, every little comment as a criticism, you know, and perhaps they weren't as mean and nasty as I thought they were, but maybe I felt so self-conscious that I was wearing, you know, hand-me-down clothes, that the looks that they were giving me, you know, maybe they weren't, you know, hateful. Maybe it was just my perception. And that's a perception I've taken through into my entire life. Oh, yeah, gracious. Okay, there we go. Okay. So fast forward, my mom passed away when I was 16 years old. I did not know she was dying. And I knew she was sick. She was in and out of the hospital. She had cancer. I used to go with her for her treatments and everything. But this is back in the days before social media, before people talked about things, you know, cancer, nobody discussed it. So I didn't know. And I was very raised in a very sheltered in mindset. So, but a fear-based mindset. I was based, you know, my entire life was based on fear that I was not good enough. And this was instilled into me, you know, by my mom. So when she passed away, I found out, you know, I happened to pick up the extension in the bedroom when my dad picked up the phone in the kitchen to learn that my mom had died in the hospital. And that's how I learned about it. And I think I was, you know, really in a state of shock for a whole year because it didn't register. It just didn't register. But all I remember is that in my culture, in my religion that I was raised in, you were not allowed to do anything for 30 days after the funeral. And I was supposed to go see Barbra Streisand on Broadway in Funny Girl. And that was my dream come true. And I was not allowed to go. And you talk about resentment. That resentment came up. Let me see, 50, 60 years later, it came up when I just did my last fourth step, that resentment about that I couldn't go, you know, talk about the innate selfishness, you know, of just, you know, wanting what I wanted. And, you know, here my mother had died, you know, and my father's grieving, you know, and I should be grieving, but what I was doing was being miserable because I couldn't go, you know, to do something that meant so much to me. But that is just how my brain worked. There was no God in my life. I wasn't raised with I was raised with traditions, but not with a sense of spirituality in my family. But I started seeking. I started seeking when I was in my teens. I felt like there's something. I wanted to know, is there a God? Is there a God? You know? and didn't find one then and there. So a year after my mom died, I met, now here I am 17, and I met a man of 19 who I'm going to cut to it because I don't have that much time. So we ended up getting married. He ended up going to Vietnam. He ended up getting killed a month before he was due to come home when he was 19. And we had a child together. I remarried rather quickly. I won't go into that story either right now, because I want to talk about the promises, because the promises of this program are something that I cherish with my entire being. Okay. So we got married. I got married to my second husband. We had two more children. He was an alcoholic. I didn't know it. I didn't know anything about alcoholism in my family. Alcohol was not ever in the home. I had never known anybody who was drunk. I didn't really know anything about alcohol. But I started, so the food. Just in case you think I might not be a food addict. Okay, I did all the things, you know, when you read in our Brown book and abstinence book, you know, all the crazy things with food. I did every single one of them. I ate out of the trash. I ate frozen food. I didn't eat food that was spoiled. Maybe it was like 30 seconds before it was going to be spoiled, I would eat it. You know, at work, you know, they would bring in pizza and I would take some and I would go into the bathroom. I would sneak out, you know, I would take, you know, three or four slices. I'd run into the bathroom, turn the water on so nobody could hear me and shove it down as fast as I possibly could. I'd have my pockets filled with candy so that I could, you know, just sneak off. It was all about the hiding. And one night when it got really bad, because I suffered from depression over these years, you know, and it was one night I was pacing in my living room, back and forth, just pacing. And my husband said, "Honey, do you need chocolate?" And I was like, "Yes." And he went to the store, he bought chocolate, he came home, I went into the bedroom, closed and locked the door so the kids wouldn't, you know, come in. And I just was stuffing myself with it. And I could feel that same feeling that I felt with the bananas. I felt with the chocolate as if I was shooting up with heroin, my entire body. Just the minute the first bite hit my mouth, it would just be the relaxation. Okay. So I was in the catering profession and I decided to go to nursing school when I was in my early 30s. And so, I mean, why not? And so I started going to school and I'm an overachiever. Whatever I do, I have to do it to perfection. And so while I was going to school, I was working the night shift. I was going to school and nursing school is an extremely intense program. And I had three children at home whom I was not raising. My husband was raising them. And my husband was, you know, he admittedly not the best father. And lots of stuff happened. And that was where, when I came to this program 40 years ago, I came in suicidal. I came in on death's door. I couldn't live anymore with myself. I couldn't stop eating. I was maybe like 20 pounds overweight. And of course I had been on every diet, yo-yo back and forth. And, you know, I had my fat clothes, my thin clothes, and there was never a normal size clothes. And so let's check the time again. He gets. So I was definitely without a doubt suicidal, but I came to this program. What was killing me was the shame and the guilt of how I lived my life and the things that I had done in my life out of selfishness, out of self-centeredness, out of fear, mostly out of fear. And when I came, you know, I jumped right into the program. By then I had already found a God of my understanding, whom I choose to call God. I knew I was powerless and I was willing to turn it over. So I walked through those doors and steps 1, 2, and 3 were done immediately. I also had to do steps 4 and 5 that same week because, like I said, those secrets, my secrets were killing me. So I, you know, wrote out a book, sat in my sponsor's living room on her floor and for 8 hours poured out my heart. I read everything. And, what was so overpowering in my that fourth step were the feelings of shame and guilt that I had to let go of. You know, I had to write a letter to my mother and take it to the cemetery and bury it. I had to write a letter to my first husband, take it to the cemetery and bury it and burn it and let go of it. Okay. That was my very first 9 steps. Okay. So what I want to read to you, the one thing that I want to, did we actually even read the promises? did we actually read through them?
They're in the chat. I was going to.
Oh, okay. No, that's okay. Cause I'm going to go ahead and read it. Yeah. I just couldn't remember, you know, having a coffee. I couldn't remember if we actually had read it before. All right. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, which is the 9th step, which is making amends, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. And I love reading these. I've been in this program for 40 years. I can recite it by heart. I know it by heart. I live it by heart because it has come true. It's come true because I've worked these steps. But I've worked them, you know, I'd love to say I came in 40 years ago and have been abstinent for 40 years. Not so much. I have been sober for 39 years and I've been abstinent for 3 years. But I am abstinent and sober this day, 24 hours. I am as abstinent as every single one of you in this room. We all have the same amount of abstinence because that's what it's it. Because I could walk out that door right after this meeting and pick something up. So we all have the same amount of abstinence. Recovery for me has been like the onion peeling, you know, you peel in stages and little by little by little, you know, I'm 72 years old now and I have a life that is beyond my wildest dreams. Absolutely. But what I want to talk about is, and I know I don't have much time, we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. Like I said, I came in here suicidal because of shame and guilt and how I neglected my children. I was emotionally unavailable to them. Well, I had to make amends for that, you know, and my amends became living amends, you know, through the years. You know, I've been I'm a mother that they can rely on, can trust. You know, I have 14 grandkids and 5 great grandkids, and every single one of them, they have not seen me in the insanity of this disease. And they know me as a loving, caring, giving person, not as the self-centered, egotistical person that I was when I was raising my own kids. You know, but I had to recently make an amends to my daughter, who's, you know, 51 now. And the freedom, you know, I had a lot of resentments towards her. You know, stuff happened in our relationship and a lot of resentments. And I told my sponsor, I'm like, I don't know if I can ever, you know, make an amends to, you know, I mean, of course I knew I could and I knew I would, but it was like, I just couldn't imagine it happening. I couldn't in my head imagine what I would say to her, how I would say it. I would be afraid and all this sort of stuff. And one day we were just sitting there on a beautiful afternoon and the words just came pouring out of my mouth, you know, making an amends, saying I was sorry for, you know, what I had done. Specific things that I had done, you know, and asked her forgiveness, you know, and of course she did, which is not always necessarily the case. You don't always get a good girl. You did good, you know, thank you. You're forgiven. But it was the most beautiful experience. And it was over and the resentments were gone. The resentments, now I'm talking long-term resentments, heavy duty resentments that I would have eaten over if given the chance, was gone. Because I made this amends. It was gone because I cleared my side of the street. You know, the promises, you know, there's a new joy, new freedom, peace, serenity, you know, self-seeking is gone. Self-pity is gone. And, you know, it's an incredible miracle that was given to me. I chose to take it, but it was given to me. You know, God gives me my recovery, you know, and it's something that it's precious to me. I don't take it lightly. If I put anything before my recovery, I'll lose my recovery. And I'm just not willing. You know I've got lots more binges in front of me, but I don't know if I have another recovery. And I'm not willing to take the chance. I'm not willing to take the chance. You know, and the last line of it, which is what I live with, we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. I could not live life on life's terms without stuffing down the feelings and the fear. I just couldn't do it. And I had a choice, death, life. I choose life today, but I choose it one day at a time, one bite at a time. And I take my program seriously. I work this program, all nine tools, everything. You know, when I first came in, I was isolated. I did not reach out. I felt like a newcomer for the first 5 years. I praise the pandemic, you know, and Zoom, because without it, I would not be sitting in a room with 47 other people listening to me rant on about whatever, you know, hopefully getting some little nugget, but it's not about me today. It's about you, every single person in this room, because each and every one of us has the hope of recovery if we do what we're supposed to do. And, you know, for me, it's all in this book. You know, I love all the other literature, but the big book for me is a textbook. It's not a novel, and I pour through it and I learn from it and I read it and I cling to every word of it because I have found that every word of it is true. And I think my time is up. So I think with that, I will pass. I will, like I said, have to cut out a few minutes early to go to get some blood work and a cup of coffee afterwards. So thank you.